Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, President Trump selects John Huntsman Jr. to be U.S. ambassador to Russia. The state of Utah and Salt Lake City pursue different tactics to try to win back the outdoor retailer show. Reaction from Utah's federal delegation, not all of it positive, on the GOP health care proposal. And the dust begins to settle on another legislative session. Joining me in the studio for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune editor-in-chief Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Thanks for being here, Jen.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you so much.
Welcome. Education reporter Benjamin Wood, welcome and thanks to you as well.
Thank you. Good morning.
Government reporter Courtney Tanner, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
And another government reporter, this kind of a theme here, Matt Piper, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And joining us via the phone is Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Good morning, Tommy.
Hey, good morning.
And listeners, you can join the conversation as well during this Friday morning news wrap-up. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Normally, the day after the legislative session ended, I'd say let's lead with that. But we learned this week that former Utah Governor John Huntsman Jr. has been tapped to be ambassador to Russia. Thomas Burr, Salt Lake Tribune, Washington, Bureau Chief. First off, have we had this confirmed from Huntsman himself yet?
He has not confirmed it. In fact, he spoke at the University of Utah yesterday and was kind of demurred when asked. He really didn't want to get into it. He hasn't responded to my texts or my calls, but that's pretty typical. When somebody's nominated for a position in an administration, they're pretty much told, like, no more interviews, don't respond, because anything they say could then be used against them in a confirmation hearing.
Sure. I understand that you have had some confirmation from a senior official in the White House on this. We discussed a little bit on the program last week when it was just a rumor. But this is obviously a pretty big appointment, one that is complicated in no small part by accusations related to Russian election hacking and accusations of close ties between the Trump campaign and Russia as well, correct?
Yeah, heck of a job to take on. Just starting with this idea, this is normally how a White House, rolls out its appointments. It doesn't just go with the first official, here's the pick and here's our great quote about why this person's great. They usually leak it out a little bit and say, hey, we picked this person, because there's ongoing vetting that happens. And so right now the process, my understanding of the White House is Huntsman's been offered the position. He said, yeah, I want it, and submitted. There's paperwork, financial paperwork. This White House apparently even goes through your social media to see what you said about the president. There's that kind of vetting that happens before they formally announce it to make sure that there's not going to be some sticking point when it goes before the Senate. But, yeah, what a job. In one way, Huntsman's not part of any of these. They're part of the campaign. He does have some ties to Russia through his family's company. But he wasn't part of any of this supposed meddling or had any discussions. As far as I know, he hasn't sat down with the Russian ambassador recently. Those are kind of good things going in. On the other side, man, in any position in the Trump administration is going to be a little tough, but this one's even worse when you've got senators and congressmen and possibly the FBI wanting to investigate what ties the Trump administration has to the country. And meanwhile, Huntsman could be sitting in Moscow having to, defend what the president says or talk to, government officials there about actions that sanctions the government may want to do.
Tommy, you spoke with a political scientist who suggested that because of all of this, of these connections and those potential investigations, Huntsman will need to be ready for just about anything.
Yeah, in fact, I've talked to a few foreign policy experts, especially those who know a lot about Russia, and one of them told me yesterday it's an impossible job. If you look at the Trump administration, is all over the place in some ways when it comes to foreign policy. The president will say one thing. Nikki Haley, the U.N. ambassador, will say another thing. There'll be a White House statement that reads something different. Sean Spicer will say something different. So it's really going to be, what is exactly going to be the marching orders going into Moscow? And how do you defend, some tweet that the president's going to toss out or some comment that another White House person is going to make that wasn't necessarily the policy plan?
Jennifer Napier Pierce, Salt Lake Tribune editor. First off, I suppose I should ask for the inevitable disclaimer or disclosure here related to the Salt Lake Tribune and its ownership.
Absolutely. This is the boss's brother. Our newspaper is owned by Paul Huntsman. Of course, John Huntsman Jr. is former governor of Utah, but he's part of the family. As Tommy said, though, I mean, this is a really tough job, and anyone who's willing to take on that job, my personal connections with him aside, you got to give it to him. You know, I mean, he, especially when President Trump has said some pretty not nice things about John Huntsman when he was ambassador to China, and throughout the campaign derided him. So for
this is when he was competing against him, correct?
Exactly. And so for John Huntsman to put those slights aside, to, you know, show that he can handle pressure and put aside his whatever personal issues he may have with the president and take on this role. And as Tommy said, a really, really tough role right now. You got to give it to him.
Another aspect of this is that John Huntsman Jr. is going, well, not directly, but, you know, from having been at one point President Obama's ambassador to China to now being President Trump's ambassador to Russia. I mean, that's kind of notable in and of itself in that it's a bridge between two pretty distinct administrations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are both powerhouses and very complicated policy connections between our two nations. And so, he's just taking on such a difficult role right now.
A reminder to our listeners that you are invited to join this conversation. Call us at 801-355-8255 or comment at sltrib.com. Tommy Burr, back to you. Huntsman had been considering a run against Senator Orrin Hatch. You would think that maybe that's not going to happen anymore, although he's being a little bit cagey, I think, about that. There was a meeting between Hatch and Huntsman a couple of days back, apparently. What happened in this meeting?
First, let me say, it's very fascinating that I don't know what he did to President Obama or President Trump for them to say, we really like you, we want to send you halfway around the world. not sure where that came from. But yes, Huntsman this week met with Senator Hatch. Apparently it was a long-standing meeting they had on the books. I don't know how coincidental it was that the White House then said, you know, the next day that they were going to appoint Huntsman to Russia. And Huntsman has not ruled out that he's considering a bid against Hatch should Hatch run again. And as reported today, Hatch apparently is on the fence and then off the fence on whether he's running. He told CNN yesterday that he's in, that the president wants him to run, and that he needs to stick around because there's important things to do.
Right.
You know, less than an hour later, his office is walking that back to me saying, you know, he still hasn't decided. It's not official. It's not formal. And I think that's the case with Hatch. It's been in my conversations, too, that in some moments he feels very much like I'm running, and, you know, 10 minutes later he's really not sure. So he's still considering the options. But let's not forget that when Obama put Huntsman in China,
right,
the idea was to, you know, get rid of a possible opponent. That didn't work because Huntsman spent 18 months in China, came back and ran for president. So it's still possible that Huntsman could go to Moscow, serve a year, come back and run for Senate.
But the timing doesn't really work out, does it, Tommy?
It's pretty difficult.
It would be very, very tight for Huntsman to come back and launch a campaign.
Yeah, unless he spends only 6 months in Russia.
Right.
Like that. And that's not really much time to get anything done. It really does sideline the idea of him running in 2018.
You know, you mentioned Hatch getting that pressure to run from President Trump. That pressure, you could imagine some people seeing that as running counter to Trump's campaign promise to drain the swamp, talking about Hatch's reelection, running for an eighth term. If you're not part of the swamp after about seven terms in office, is anybody part of the swamp?
You know, I don't know what makes you turn into an alligator, but I don't know how much time that takes, actually.
Okay.
You know, it's very interesting to see. I talked to, obviously, a critic of Orrin Hatch, who, by the way, had promised in 2012 that he was not going to run again, that was going to be his final race. And Connor Boyack, president of Libertas Institute, was like, look, you know, he's getting all this pressure to run from people who get money off of him, lobbyists and others who really see him as their meal ticket. But there's no question that if you're going to drain the swamp, the term limits and not running for office for an eighth time would be part of that.
And the counter to that, obviously, is that he does have a position of power. He can advocate for the state of Utah. You know, with Huntsman out of the picture, assuming that he is out of the picture, does anyone stand in the way of Hatch, should he decide to run, winning re-election, or has anyone hinted that they might run against him?
Well, I think we've seen a laundry list of people. Josh Romney would be close to the top of that list. I think, you know, he may be thinking more governor now. Jason Chaffetz has talked about it, but I think he's also leaning towards running for governor. We have plenty of other people. Boyd Matheson, who runs the Sutherland Institute, is in the running. I think there's plenty of people like Derek Miller, World Trade Center, who've talked about running as well. So I don't think there'll be any shortage of people who would run. Whether they can mount a campaign against somebody who has the name ID and the approval rating of Hatch would be tough.
And let's remember, you know, when Mike Lee was running for re-election, early in his tenure, there people were lining up, they were disgusted with his service, and one by one, they went by the wayside, and he was not contested by another Republican. So I don't think you can discount the power of incumbency when it comes to Hatch.
But maybe not exactly a cakewalk either. I guess we'll see in the coming year or so what's going to happen. I want to turn to another story or two before we hit our first break. But Thomas Burr, Salt Lake Tribune, Washington Bureau Chief, I know that we have to let you go. I want to thank you for taking the time this morning to join us.
Of course. Thank you.
Courtney Tanner, let's stick with some news out of Washington for just a moment longer before we head into the state legislative session. Yesterday, the Republican proposal to repeal the Affordable Care Act and replace it with a system of tax credits, while kind of rolling back the expanded Medicaid that came with the Affordable Care Act, that received the approval of two committees in the U.S. House of Representatives. You, earlier this week, sought reaction from Utah's congressional delegation on this plan, and you found that Senator Mike Lee wasn't exactly on board with the plan. Tell us why.
Mike Lee thinks that it's a little too similar to Obamacare, and so he's against it, and he says, you know, this isn't the bill that we're waiting for, and so he's kind of leading this, I guess, faction against it, and it could falter really easily because there's this slim majority of Republicans in the House right now, and if a couple of Republicans switch over, then the bill's going to fail.
And it's, I mean, it seems like as a result, it's going to be a contentious fight. And I know that Senator Lee is one of, as you said, a handful of Republicans who are maybe defecting. On the other side of that, we have Representative Jason Chaffetz. Well, not exactly on the other side of that. He hasn't exactly endorsed or, gotten rid of or said that this plan is not worth what it purports to be. But he did make a comment related to the plan that caused some backlash. He did this in the media this week. Correct?
Yeah, he basically said that low-income Americans are going to have to make some harder choices with this new healthcare plan, and he pretty much leveled it down to buying a new iPhone or paying for health insurance.
Jennifer Napier-Pierce, has the Salt Lake Tribune or the Tribune editorial board weighed in on the new GOP healthcare plan with its own editorial?
Well, we certainly weighed in on Chaffetz's tone deafness. I mean, he makes such a false equivalency, and we saw websites popping up within minutes. How many iPhones will it cost to get your mammogram? You know, I mean, it's just ridiculous that he would even make this comparison. Nobody is offering you a deal like an iPhone, and it just feels so insensitive in so many ways. I just think that Chaffetz needs a reality check when it comes to people's real healthcare quandaries. I mean, healthcare is not cheap, and it's not the decision between an iPhone and going to the dentist.
Right. Guys, we could spend the entire hour talking about healthcare and debating the bill, but I do want to save time, and in fact, most of the rest of the hour for the state legislative session. But before we move on to other stories, we'll need to take a quick break and just have some messages. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us. We'll return in a moment. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce and reporters Benjamin Wood, Matt Piper, and Courtney Tanner. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. The 2017 Utah State Legislature came to a close, ready or not, at midnight last night. Major topics of the session included liquor laws, public lands, education funding, guns, homelessness, and Nephites. We'll get to that cryptic reference in just a minute. But before we do, let's start with education funding. Benjamin Wood, you were there till the session adjourned at midnight. Later, actually. And so thanks for making it here this morning.
I'm happy to be here.
There has been some pressure for years on lawmakers to increase education funding, given the state's, it's often cited that we're the lowest in the nation in per pupil spending. But lawmakers had added pressure this year, and they did find some additional funding for schools this year. How much additional money are we talking about?
For K-12, you know, elementary, middle, high school, it's about 240, give or take. I mean, it depends on what you lump into the category, but about $240 million new for public ed.
And that amount was a pretty sizable amount. In fact, I think lawmakers got some thank you letters from teachers, but it wasn't enough to stop a planned ballot initiative to raise taxes for education. The group Our Schools Now released a statement yesterday saying that their signature gathering effort is essentially still a go?
Yeah, they are charging forward, looking ahead to the ballot in 2018. And you're right. I mean, it was a lot of money, but at the same time, it's, you know, the public education is funded through the income tax. The income tax grows every year. And so just by nature of how our state is set up, that money flows to schools. So Our Schools Now has been saying, you know, these annual increases are great, but they're also just a product of trends. And so Our Schools Now is saying we need to do something beyond the trends. We need to take action. We need to turn the dials a little bit and do even more.
A radical step, essentially. Lawmakers, though, threw a kind of wrench in the gears, or at least slightly complicated the Our Schools Now initiative with a bill that they passed last night. They want clarity on the initiative forms that the group gets signatures on. Tell us about this.
Yeah, and they passed a bill that says, you know, if you're going to do an initiative to raise taxes, you have to list very clearly both the tax rate increase, so in this case, the 7/8 of 1% number we hear, but also the relative change, and that's 17.5%, you know, going from 5 to 5 7/8. And, you know, it's been something that lawmakers were really concerned about, this idea that that voters are going to be confused. They're going to think, oh, 7/8 of 1%, that's hardly anything. Oh, here's my signature. Let's get on the ballot. I don't think there's any way to know for sure if voters aren't grasping the size of this proposed tax increase. And I think there's a lot of people who can do the math going from 5 to 5.875. But regardless, it is now law that when you sign the petition form, it will say in 14-point bold font on every single page, you know, it's a 7/8 of 1%, and it's a 17.5%.
Was 14-point bold specified in the
bill? It was.
Itself? Wow. Okay.
And the bill originally would have made that disclaimer, you know, 100 times on a sheet of paper, and they walked that back a little bit. So now it'll just be one nice little disclaimer
at the bottom of the page. You know, lawmakers actually had been saying that they were worried about Our Schools Now initiative because of they think that it's going to put a damper on economic growth in the state. That's their kind of major concern with this, correct?
Yeah, you know, Senate President Wayne Niederhauser, he talked about that a lot. You know, they view an income tax as a tax on productivity, and the idea being when you raise that tax, you discourage productivity. And, you know, there's differences of opinion on the effect of an income tax increase, but, you know, lawmakers who have been there for a while, when they cut the income tax in 2000, you know, seven-ish, you know, they saw a boom in growth. They've seen a decade of healthy growth, and they're worried about affecting that.
And it's $220 million, you said, additional this year. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, turning to you and looking again for the Tribune's sort of editorial voice here, any increase in education spending must be a welcome thing here in Utah.
Absolutely. I mean, our editorial position has always been more money for schools, more better. You know, I mean, it just makes sense to invest in the future. And really, that's the future of our economy. It's the future of communities, and so it just makes a lot of sense. I think Our Schools Now, maybe you can correct me, Ben, but Our Schools Now, I think that they misjudged a little bit. They brought this initiative proposal before the legislature last year, didn't go anywhere. This year, same thing. And I think that they were hoping for an outcome like Count My Vote got a few years ago with SB 54. Basically, that was an initiative for election reform. And it came before legislators, and they were able to strike a deal to make the initiative essentially go away. And so now when we have these school funders, you know, these education proponents saying, okay, we're going to take this directly to the people, I think that they thought strategically that the legislature would bend. You know, legislators would say, oh, well, let's strike a deal.
Putting their feet to the fire.
Yeah, they didn't quite get the bargain they were hoping for.
They didn't, and you're right. I mean, at the beginning of the session, there was a lot of talk, you know, will there be an SB 54 type compromise? But one thing you have to remember is it's no accident that this initiative would hit in 2018. You know, there is still one more legislative session. And Syme Dye last night, when the governor visited both chambers, he said, you know, tax reform is the top agenda item next year. And so, I mean, if there's still time for a deal, when they convene next January, the ballot initiative is going to be a much more clear and present danger to lawmakers. And so that, you know, if there were to be a deal, one might expect it to come next session.
Mm. Right before the initiative process begins.
Right. And as voters are talking about it and they have it before them, and it's really seeing that the momentum is there, if there is momentum at the time.
Okay. A quick reminder to listeners that we want to hear your thoughts on these stories. Call us at 801-355-8255. You can also comment at sltrib.com. I feel like we can't linger on any one topic here. There's just too much to try and cover from the legislature. Let's move to alcohol. And Ben, you also had a hand in covering that topic for the Trib this year. There was a concerted effort to repeal or undo or tear down the Zion Curtain, the so-called Zion Curtain in Utah restaurants. But that effort led to something that last week on the show we referred to as Zion Options. In the end, restaurants will have some choices to make when it comes to how they prepare and serve alcoholic drinks.
Yeah, we didn't quite bring down that wall this year. But like I said, there are several Zion options now. There is a moat, which, you know, some lawmakers find an offensive term, various buffer zones and barriers and walls. But essentially, yes, you know, for a restaurateur in the state now, you know, depending on the layout or the structure of their restaurant, they can choose different options to keep children away from the preparation of alcohol.
One thing about this, the Zion Curtain, you could be grandfathered out of if you were a restaurant. It was meant to apply to, for the most part, to new restaurants. The new regulations mean that every restaurant out there in the state is going to have to adopt one of these options, correct?
That's right. No more grandfathering. And that was one of the big hurdles that the bill ran into, because there's a lot of restaurants, older restaurants particularly, that, you know, for them to transition to a Zion Curtain or any of these various options, it could be detrimental to their business operations. So without that grandfathering, you do see some angst among the restaurant community. But the lawmakers are pretty confident that between one of the various options out there, there's a way to make it work.
Well, that's one part of what happened with alcohol policy in the state. There was also an additional markup on alcohol sales, with the proceeds of that markup going to efforts to prevent underage drinking, in part. Lawmakers also passed a bill making the DUI threshold lower, correct?
That's right. In fact, the lowest in the nation, 0.05. And, the effective date on that isn't until December 30th of next year. So there is a little time if you know, people get cold feet or, you know, buyer's remorse. But yes, as of, you know, the governor said that he's supportive, it's very likely that Utah will have the lowest BAC limit in the nation.
Last year, the LDS Church weighed in on this. Jennifer, maybe I'll turn to you for this comment. But Utah liquor laws were fine the way they were, said the church at the time. Maybe I don't know if you can address this, but has the church weighed in on this at all this session and had an effect?
I do not know.
I'll turn to you.
I mean, the lobbyists are always up there, but I don't know what they were saying on this one.
I would imagine it's safe to assume they weighed in behind closed doors. But as far as a public statement, it's anyone's
guess. Very, very rare.
You know, talking about the LDS Church, I realize that we have to turn to a comedic slip-up in the final days of the session. Senate President Wayne Niederhauser misspoke, and it caused a few chuckles in the mostly Mormon body. What was this about, Ben, just as a sidetrack for a moment?
Sure, and I'll try to set the stage because it's very procedural, but, you know, as you're on the floor, these bills, every time that they vote on a bill, they have to read it in, its number, its title. It's very formulaic. It's very repetitive. And there was a bill that was on its third substitute. And so in order to vote on it, you have to say, you know, third substitute, House Bill 6 million, et cetera, and then read the title. And, you know, President Niederhauser, it's late. It's the second to last night of the session, and he's going through the motions, and he reads out Third Nephi, which is a book in the Book of Mormon, in the Mormon canon. And, you know, it's a largely LDS chamber. So it was one of those moments of levity that just kind of put us into the last down the hill.
And it has to happen towards the end of the session when people are beginning to, show their wear, I guess, a moment of levity.
I mean, there was a similar moment that we didn't, I mean, earlier on where one of the reading clerks had referred to Senator Henderson as Sister Henderson. So, I mean, from time to time on the Hill, you do hear some Utah vernacular creeping in.
Of course. Well, I want to turn to, there's a lot to cover here from the legislative session. I want to turn to another major topic this year on and off the Hill, and that was homelessness. A couple of weeks back, House Speaker Greg Hughes, Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski, and Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams and others held a press conference and kind of changed the plan on homelessness. Salt Lake City would house two 200-bed shelters. The county would get one. There was a bill related to this that passed last night, House Bill 441, which says that a municipality essentially can't reject a shelter site that is selected for them. Matt, do you know much about this bill and the fact that now, I guess, once the process has gone through at the county side, a municipality won't be able to say no? Is that correct?
That is, yeah. Ultimately, the decision will fall to a state homeless coordinating committee, but their decision will be based on a recommendation from the county, which will be coming very soon. Essentially, what Representative Gibson's bill did was finish funding for the construction of these three shelters, or at least the state's portion of that funding, which is $20 million. And it gave County Mayor Ben McAdams a realistic way to site a homeless shelter within the next month. I think the state always has the ability to trump city ordinances or zoning, but this spells out very clearly a municipality in Salt Lake County is going to get a homeless shelter, and it may have some say through the public input in the process, but it's not going to have any real teeth in whether or not it gets a shelter within its borders.
Well, there's supposed to be a new strategy at play here, and the state is putting money into these shelters, into these resource centers. How much money is the state actually ponying up for this?
So, grand total, I think with services, it's the $27 million is the number that you keep hearing. Although, the plan also includes affordable housing, substance abuse and mental health treatment, and it gets more complicated when you try to tally up all those dollars. But one thing that you saw this session was sort of a concerted effort to tackle the problem on a number of different fronts. Pamela Atkinson, the longtime homeless advocate here, has said that this was a session unlike any she's seen before, and that progress was made in the multifaceted ways that they needed to see to really get people not only in better shelters or better managed shelters, but to have available housing for them, to have the treatment dollars that they need to get on a path toward success, or at least housing, permanent housing.
Jennifer Napier Pierce, editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, what's to account for that, new focus, the fact that the legislature took this up and did something with it this year?
Gosh, again, as the outside observer, I guess I take two things away from this. Mayor McAdams knows how to get things done in a way that Salt Lake City doesn't. He, I'm sure, is using his prior experience as a state senator to work things his way. And so for him to sort of have this unilateral control over where the next shelter is going to be and cities be damned is quite remarkable. The other thing is the other takeaway for me is just the muscle that Speaker Greg Hughes had in this process. He is the one who said, we are getting this done and we're going to give money, but you must agree and set the terms, and voila, it happened. I come away thinking this guy is the most powerful man in the state.
Well, and just going back to County Mayor Ben McAdams for a moment, he can also point to the state and say, look, this is, once the decision is made, it's not me who's who's forcing you to take this.
It does give him an out. It definitely gives him an out, and probably suits his future political goals. And that's the cynic in me.
Yet to be determined. Matt, Salt Lake County site selection process going on. Where are we in that? They had pledged to be transparent about making that decision. What's going on there?
Right, and I think the key point here is that that's very different from the approach taken by Salt Lake City, and I think it purposely is. It may not have been done this way had they not seen the reaction to what happened here in Salt Lake when they cited four homeless shelters that they've since cut down to two and had led to some pretty serious uproar, especially over one shelter that was previously cited in Sugar House. So anyway, with that background, the county has decided to court public input, and they have to have a site recommendation by the end of the month. So next week they'll have the first of two open houses up at the Capitol, and then I think they'll have another chance to address the committee after that. Three total public input opportunities by the end of the month, and they will present, I think, about five site finalists for the public to vet and give their concerns.
But the tremendous sacrifice is transparency. It is public input, and public input and democracy are messy. And it's sad for me to see that the state is really plowing forward. I think, you know, Hughes would say it's strong leadership, but for those of us who like the process, it's not a good sign.
You know, the county county mayor, and I'm sure anybody who's working on this issue would say any neighborhood, any municipality needs to be charitable, needs to admit that this is part of their community. But for the most part, I think don't people generally I'm thinking about the open house you're describing, Matt. Aren't people going to show up and just say, not in my neighborhood, not in my neighborhood, not in my neighborhood?
Well, that's exactly what we saw at the city level. So I can't imagine that it won't be at least largely that. And I think that it's going to be a real challenge for the county to not just bend to the pressure of the loudest voices in the room.
Okay. Guys, we have a comment here from a caller who didn't stay on the line, but Georgia from Cedar City. She wants you guys to comment on what you thought the legislature pushed aside that should have had more attention this session. And does anybody have a sort of list of things that might have been addressed but that didn't get the full, the full vetting that they needed? Benjamin Wood, for example.
Yeah, I mean, every year, especially with the session occurring in the winter months, there's always talk about air quality. I wouldn't be the first person to say, but there were several bills on this subject that just didn't really go anywhere. To lawmakers' credit, though, they did take some steps. They funded some new air quality monitoring that the governor had asked for. And there's an interesting tax incentive, which is kind of a problematic idea, but they're offering $1.8 million to oil refineries who voluntarily move to Tier 3 fuels, which, if lawmakers are to be believed, would have a significant impact on our air quality. So you could list several things. One more thing on education funding. There was a bill that would have raised tax revenue for schools. It would have frozen a property tax for the next 5 years that otherwise adjusts downward as property values go up.
Right.
It was in the House being debated at the stroke of midnight. I mean, it was on the board. It just ran out of time. And it could have grown to be $100 million over 5 years.
I imagine there were a number of things that didn't make it just because of the time constraints in the end. Do they ever – well – special sessions, those happen on occasion. guys, we've got to take another quick break, but still to come, more from the last night, of the 2017 state legislative session that closed up shop at midnight. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier Pierce, Matt Piper, Benjamin Wood, and Courtney Tanner. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions. The number to call is 801-355-TALK. You can also comment at the Salt Lake Tribune's website, sltrib.com. We've got so much to cover still from the state legislative session, from gun bills to public lands to, I don't know, the state prison. Or to how the state dealt with the Bears Ears National Monument and a stance on public lands in general. You know, let's actually turn to that. The Outdoor Industry Association earlier in the session said that it was leaving Utah, and this was in response to essentially what was happening at the legislature and a resolution having to do with the Bears Ears National Monument, but more generally having to do with public lands policy in the state. Matt Piper, the legislature is trying to woo them back, reinstating a $1 million subsidy for the group that normally exists, but this year, because they were leaving, they were going to get rid of it. Meanwhile, Salt Lake City made its own overture to outdoor retailers, and this was something that you followed. The city is saying, look, we're not the state, we're not the legislature, we want you back. Tell us what the city is doing, Matt.
Yeah, so, I mean, 3 weeks late, I think it's worth noting, the Salt Lake City Council had a resolution saying that, you know, we'd love to continue a dialogue with the outdoor retailer industry about the environment. And, you know, I don't know what exactly that's worth at this point. You know, it was sort of interesting to me, at least I thought, from an outside perspective, as somebody who wasn't covering the story at that time, but you saw the state's top-ranking Democrats sort of silent on that issue as Outdoor Retailer was making its exit. You know, they had the last-minute phone call with Governor Herbert, but you didn't see Salt Lake City or county mayors on the steps somewhere urging the state to reconsider or urging even Outdoor Retailer publicly to begin a dialogue with them. Which was surprising to me, given that they share a lot of the same values, and you would have thought they could have had a pretty good conversation about what Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County think of Utah's public lands. But anyway, that aside, the Salt Lake City Council took the best stab at it that it could at this point. And as you said, the state legislature preserved a $1 million subsidy that at least, you know, keeps the lifeline there.
We don't know what kind of an effect this will. So a late effort by the city to try and win back the OR show. The city's position is look, we want you to come back. We have a vested interest here. You're hurting businesses, hotels, restaurants, the local income. But of course, organizers of the show would say, this is the state's fault, not our fault, and we're not to blame. You know, blame your elected officials. Jennifer Napier, Pierce Tribune editor. First off, has the outdoor industry, by playing this card, by leaving, by threatening to leave and then leaving, have they now sort of lost their leverage in the state over this issue?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, the outdoor industry is huge here. Tourism is huge, and it has real economic effects. The thing that I come away with, both from the resolution and the $1 million incentive by state legislators, there really are two narratives here. One is legislators see this as a money deal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all about money, whereas the outdoor folks see policy as at the center of this disagreement. And so I don't know if they're ever going to be able to see eye to eye. I can't imagine this resolution is going to make any difference at all.
There's no middle ground between what you're describing, the policy action and the money, two sort of differing viewpoints on what this is actually about. It's interesting. Have we heard from outdoor retailers on whether or not, in response to the resolution from the city?
The latest that I'd heard the day of the resolution is that the county hadn't heard anything from outdoor retailer, but I couldn't tell you what the latest is at the state level.
Okay. Guys, we're low on time, and I want to get the highlights of the legislative session covered, and so I'm going to turn to Courtney Tanner. And this is a sort of an abrupt turn, but a measure that would lower the age at which a person can get a concealed carry permit that passed in the legislative session. This is lowering it from what to what?
I hope I'm correct on this. It's lowering it from 21 to 18. So now anyone that's 18 or older can get a permit for this. And the idea behind it, according to the bill's sponsor, was that it's going to help protect women, particularly in college, that can apparently now pack heat if they want to.
Well, and they can do it if they conceal it now. Of course, I guess anybody who's 18 or above in the state of Utah can carry openly a weapon. But this is now they can get a concealed carry permit. We talked about a bill that didn't make it to the end of the session last week, a bill that would have eliminated the need for concealed carry permits altogether for anybody over the age of 21. That didn't make it to the end in part because of some domestic violence provisions that the NRA objected to, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Yeah, the National Rifle Association kind of brought some opposition late in the bill, which caused the bill sponsor to kind of pull back on it. The bill sponsor had added a provision that people with domestic violence convictions or restraining orders against them, this wouldn't apply to them, so they wouldn't be able to have this provision. And so it kind of got pulled after that.
There was another measure on gun ownership and domestic violence that I think that did pass yesterday. This is by Democratic Representative Brian King. And I'm just curious about the difference between that bill and what was in the bill that the NRA objected to. Are they similar?
They're similar. King's bill restricts people also with convictions on domestic violence and protective orders from owning a firearm. And that's already in, like, federal law, but this kind of helps local law enforcement, gives them the resources to enforce that.
Okay, guns, a sort of major topic at the legislature every year. Going back to the lowering the concealed carry age limit, 18-year-olds with concealed weapons, Jennifer, critics have said 18 is way too young.
Well, the argument is, but you can go to in the military and carry a gun at 18, so why couldn't you do a concealed carry? I think the great irony of, I'm blanking on the representative's name who was the sponsor, she was saying it was for the protection of college students, you know, to fight the rape epidemic. And you cannot carry a concealed gun on most college campuses in the state of Utah. So I don't know. It's a shrug.
Okay, a shrug on that one. Let's turn to what might be another shrug here, and that is the topic of polygamy. Utah is further criminalizing polygamy or trying to reinstate, I guess, certain I don't know. I don't really understand this bill, actually. Ben Wood, what is the state doing with polygamy?
Yeah. So Utah's bigamy law, as I said on our little live blog last night, that it's been through the court ringer. You know, there's been various provisions making it illegal several times over, but recent court decisions have chipped away at that to the point where it's rather toothless at the moment. So what this bill does is it now says that if you are cohabitating and that's the kind of important distinction, and purporting to be married to multiple partners, you are in violation of the state's bigamy law. There potential for charges there. You know, this was the big last hurrah of the session last night before we adjourned. It had been a sleepy day until all of a sudden bigamy came up and things got spicy. But you know, it's just an interesting argument, because on the one side you have lawmakers who say, you know, the state's constitution says that bigamy will always be illegal in the state. And then you have others saying, you know, the real thing we're trying to target here is child bride trafficking and domestic abuse. And by criminalizing bigamy, we're making it so people can't come forward and we can't go after those crimes. So there's been a lot of back and forth on that bill.
Is there an enforcement element to this bill? Because really, that's been the whole thing. I mean, it's part of the Constitution. You will not have more than one wife. There's been sort of this turning the blind eye to that for many years because, you know.
Because of religious.
I mean, does this bigamy bill do anything on the enforcement end?
The sponsors would certainly say it does. You know, on the other hand, it's been a while since we charged anyone with bigamy,
right,
and successfully prosecuted them.
Right.
So, I mean, well, I think it's one of these bills where only time will tell. You know, there may be some enforcement done that might result in further court challenges, or it might not. I mean, there's a lot of unknown at this point.
I find it really interesting that they decide to step into this space at this moment when everyone's sort of reevaluating the definition of what marriage is anyway. So I'm puzzled by this last minute foray
and whether or not
there
can be enforcement, and you know, something that the state has struggled with for decades. In fact, one part of this, Ben, that I think is really interesting is the purporting to be in a bigamous relationship. It has to be and purporting
and,
to be.
Yes.
So you are both cohabitating and purporting.
That's right. Previously, the law said or, and that was one of the areas that the courts had targeted. This people who are living together without being married. I mean,
yeah,
lots of people would raise their hand in the state if you're using that measure. So this bill, by doing that and, it looks to capture specifically polygamous arrangements. we'll see.
Yeah, you guys, with the final 2 minutes of the show that we have here, I want to turn to the. I want to ask about the processes in place. There was an article in this morning's Salt Lake Tribune about the passage of bills being less than transparent. And one spot in particular where this was apparent, actually two spots really, was a $1 billion bond measure and also $100 million in additional funding for the state prison. Critics are saying this didn't get a good public airing. Legislators are saying sometimes you have to keep things secret for them to actually advance. Is that essentially the argument here?
Yeah, that is the argument. I mean, and this session, if you were to kind of wrap it up, I mean, there's two bills that personify this session. There was the big comprehensive sales tax reform package that we talked about every single day for a month, and it never materialized. Bill never even came out. On the other hand, you had this $1 billion bond that no one saw coming, and all of a sudden it appeared and was passed the next day. So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, lawmakers, they say in order to get people on board and at the table and talking, you sometimes have to go behind closed doors. But, you know, it was just one of those things. The big issues we were talking about fizzled, and then the things we weren't talking about shot right through.
At the end of the session, Jennifer Napier Pierce, any comment on the transparency of the lawmaking, the sausage-making process?
It's ugly. I think a lot of people don't want to look at it, but I think it's important for us to know exactly how these deals are struck. I am troubled by the excuse that, well, we can't get anything done if it's done in public. You know, people can't be honest and speak their minds. Well, you know, at some point you got to just take a risk and say, this is democracy, and I'm going to say something, and it may be unpopular, and, you know, face the consequences.
Right. Okay. Well, guys, we are unfortunately out of time. A lot of topics from the legislative session we didn't get to, but there is amazing summaries of coverage at the Salt Lake Tribune's website, sltrib.com. Check out the blog from last night, the final day of the legislative session. That's really interesting to see as well. We do need now to turn to our underplayed stories of the week, and Jennifer Napier Pierce, are you ready with an underplayed story?
I am. You know, the Salt Lake City School Board has been petitioned by a group of young folks who say, please don't enforce federal immigration law in the public schools. They've presented a resolution. The school board wants more time. I think from the editorial board's position, we say, go ahead. You know, make sure that schools are a safe zone, that this is not a place where people have to fear for to be deported. I mean, that's not the aim of public schools.
Okay, pass this resolution from the Tribune. Matt Piper, how about your pick for an underplayed story of the week?
You know, I have not seen much of the Utah Jazz this year, but they're in fourth place, and it's getting to be about time to start paying attention for casual fans like myself. But I was excited to hear that Rudy Gobert has a mysterious design shaved into his head, and his teammates have theories. They think maybe it's a secret, the initials of a secret girlfriend, or it's an homage to Harry Potter. But the towering Frenchman is silent on the issue thus far.
I'm going to go with crop circles. That's my guess. Courtney Tanner, your underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, Peggy Fletcher Stack had this really beautiful piece about this new Catholic bishop that was installed in the Salt Lake City Diocese.
Okay, yeah, that's it's a long and interesting piece that you can check out at the Salt Lake Tribune's website, sltrib.com. Benjamin Wood, your underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, there's a story today by our newest colleague, Kelly Gifford, about a team from Navajo Mountain High School participating in the first robotics contest. This is one of our smallest and most rural high schools. We don't often see teams from these schools able to travel to Salt Lake County to participate in these statewide competitions. And so Kelly, you know, she's a new member of our health ed desk, my desk. And it's a nice story looking at rural students participating in, you know, the big city fun of the public education system.
You know, because we've got just a minute more, I want to ask you actually about another thing that didn't pass at the legislative session, and the robotics thing reminded me of it. There was a personal
Milo?
Robot. Yeah, Milo the robot.
Milo.
Tell us what happened with Milo and who he was, what was going to, he, I don't know, who the
yeah.
robot was.
And yeah,
what
and,
was
gonna... and Milo the robot, most people will not care. It was just one of these obscure things that caught my eye that I just ended up following for the last 2 weeks. But there is a company called RoboKind, based out of Texas, that builds robots that are that are intended for use with children with autism. They have facial features, interactive software, and the idea is for children who struggle with social interaction, the robot kind of helps bridge that gap.
Right.
It's an interesting program. What had happened with this particular proposal was Representative Brad Lass had put forward a bill that would say, okay, the state will put out $200,000, schools will match it, and will help buy some of these robots. And it was interesting because in his presentation, he talked about how, you know, this is emerging technology. We don't even know if it actually works. But hey, it sounds nice. There's some schools that might want to buy it, so let's help them. Bill died, but then the funding remained in the budget. And so there was this weird back and forth of, are we buying the robots? Are we not buying the robots? Are we buying the robots? It turned out at the end of the day, we're not going to buy the robots. Schools can buy them themselves. I mean, there's nothing to stop a school from buying their own robot.
But no funding from the state level.
Yeah, the state's not involved.
Okay. Benjamin Wood with two forced underplayed stories of the week there. I'm going to go with one that Courtney Tanner actually reported in the Salt Lake Tribune. KCPW is here in the wall of the main library downtown. There's a guy named Bernie Hart who has for quite a while now been leading Tai Chi classes for the homeless here on Library Square. He and his wife give people a breakfast burrito and a couple of bucks to take part. And they're doing this all of their own accord, but they've been a constant here at the library, and resident homeless take part in this Tai Chi class every, I can't remember the mornings that it happens, but it's pretty remarkable to see. In addition to the story that Courtney wrote, there are some great photos, and of course you can check them out at the Tribune's website, sltrib.com. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Benjamin Wood, Courtney Tanner, and Matt Piper, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and to KCPW's Emily Means. And thanks to you as well for tuning in. You can find podcasts at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you back here next Friday.